State Affairs Committee meeting will come to order, please. We start off today with the hearing on Senate Bill 257, which is a bill establishing Alaska Natural Gas Industrial Development Authority. It's sponsored by Senator Parr, and Senator Parr is here to give us a statement of intent and to take us through the purposes of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill is a reintroduction in a different form of a bill that was introduced 2 years ago, which is not the action. I don't know at this moment for sure whether the time has passed or not on this. It may be too late, and at least that would be the reason I'm going to introduce the bill. As you know, Mr. Chairman, the legislature several years ago established the Gas Pipeline Financing Authority in order to have a vehicle which could, if the legislature so decided, issue $1 billion in tax-free bonds, which would then become loan capital for the construction of natural gas pipeline. Bill I introduced 2 years ago to have a state fund the conditioning plant was completely separate from that $1 billion. The bill is before you this time says that you use the authority to issue the bonds for the conditioning plant. So I'm afraid that the letter from the Commissioner of Natural Resources is not 100% accurate, because it gives the impression that the bill is simply a reintroduction of the original bill. It's not. Mr. Chairman, the question of state financing of the gas line, I mean, to spend it all, has been around for several years since Mr. McMillan in Northwest came down here and made a proposal for $1 billion of loan money and $500 million in equity. The legislature has been, you know, highly skeptical on that subject, when the authority was established, it was hedged around with quite a few conditions that had to be met before there was any consideration of the investment. The Joint Gas Pipeline Committee, and I'm sure Senator Federal will remember this, because both members did deal with this topic before, and a meeting in Anchorage in the summer of the late early fall, late summer, as they fall, I guess, in 1979, we had reports from various consultants on this issue, among others, and we did have a representative from Lazard Prayer, which is with our financial consultant, and I'd like to read very briefly, if I might, Mr. Chairman, a few minutes of that. Mr. Peter Lewis, representative firm. Lou is a consultant for the gas pipeline. He reported on four alternatives to state financial participation in the gas pipeline project. First, the state ownership of the conditioning plant. Second, tax-exempt bond up to $1 billion. Third, insurance fund overruns. And four, equity participation in the pipeline itself. The Resort Prayer prefers the option of state ownership of the conditioning plant. This option gives the state leverage. The conditioning plant is essential to the entire project. The state does not have to run the plant, but should hold tight. The conditioning plant could hardly be financed by tax-exempt bonds. The debt would be non-recourse financing, which the state would not be liable for debt. The rate of return estimated lose would be about 17.5%, the same as a pipeline in any rate of return. This option is low risk, with high reward, yielding more to Alaska than the other financing options. And there was a detailed opinion then the Attorney General in the early 20th and 1990s. I'll have to say in passing that the first time the bill was introduced, I thought there would still be hope of having the state determine the location of the conditioning plant rather than leaving that up to the Northwest to determine. I don't know if that's longer a viable option. However, I think it is important that if any money the state is going to run this system, that it should go in a condition plan. If we are simply in as on a loan basis, for instance, loan capital, we have no control whatsoever. If we go on an equity basis in the pipeline itself, we'd be a minority stockholder, and again, we would have very little leverage. However, the gas cannot be shipped to the lower 48 without being conditioned. If we own the conditioning plant, Northwest, and the other transfer pipeline companies, the consortium, and the producers, and the federal government, all to some extent, at least appeal to the government. We have a position of strength there which we do not get any other way. So I think that if we are going to make such investments, certainly the conditioning plant would be the place to do it. One other point, Mr. Chairman, I don't take too much of your time, but the letter from the Commission of Natural Resources also refers to some of the conditions I mentioned a while ago, which were put in when the Alaska Pipeline Financing Authority started. And we put all those conditions in there because we were talking about the state simply lending $1 billion to Northwest Pipeline. To the extent to which we need those conditions, if we actually own the gas conditioning plant, to which all of this must go is another matter. I have an objection to the commission to the conditions being kept in some way, but they're not nearly as essential as it would be if we were simply lending the state money.
I have a number of questions at the start, mostly clarifying in nature. Did you say that in creation of the proposed Alaska Natural Gas Industrial Development Authority, you would not be repealing the existing section creating the Alaska Gas Pipeline Financing Authority, or did you intend to repeal it?
No, sir, did not. I intended to have the authority instead of simply existing for one single purpose, which was to lend them $1 billion to tax the bond. Instead of having existing for that purpose, it would exist for the purpose of the bond issue for building the conditioning plant.
And the two authorities would be the same authority?
It's intended to be, yes.
I see. Okay. That's,
I'm not being an attorney, or maybe something that's in the bill is not clear on that point. But
on page 3, section 87, the revenue fund, it establishes a special fund known as the Gas Conditioning Plant Revenue Fund. Is there any constitutional problem with this becoming a dedicated fund? Or?
I don't believe so, sir, because this is what we cannot dedicate is our tax revenue. And this is talking about something that the state would be issuing bonds, or the authority to issue the bond, and the money would come back into it. So I don't think it's a constitutional problem.
On page 9, I understand at the bottom, subsection 11, committee means state bond committee. You intend for the authority to utilize the state bond committee for purposes of the bonds, even though it would be essentially an independent authority.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I haven't had a question come up before, and I don't really know what whether it's required or not. I wouldn't have any special reason to want to go through the bond authority. I'm just trying to find the place that committee was used in there about issuing the bond.
Yeah, I noticed it down there. So there's some
definition somewhere. I'm not certain where it appears otherwise. Or if the committee is authorized for the bond resolution. But I wouldn't have any, if we've done either way as far as I'm concerned, I just don't know that. So do you think we'd have to ask the bond council, which would be the best way to go over the question there? At least from what my observation seems bond accounts are very sticky with that, exactly some of that.
You mentioned before the question of location at the top of page 11. If the state did have the say on location, would you feel that there should be any legislative criteria as to location, or should that be left completely to the Oil Gas Advisory Board?
The original bill did have legislative approval of a decision made by the Oil and Gas Advisory Board. There are, as you know, Mr. Chairman, constitutional questions at each line of the executive branch on that subject. And so this bill did not include it. I might like to have the decision, the basis of the decision, in my mind, should be the greatest benefit to the state, not the greatest benefit to ARCO, Exxon, Ohio, or Northwest. And the decision apparently has been made so far, and I suppose it's continued to be made by those people because they're the ones putting in the money. But I think there's some very good, there are some very good reasons for not leaving it up to them. I don't think the original decision, at least the information we had at the time, certainly was a logical decision. They would have used, as you remember, somewhere between 50 and 60% of all the gas liquids to fuel the plant. We all agreed that it was waste, it could not be tolerated. Now, there's a new design concept, and I'm not certain what that does in terms of how much liquid they use. But it at least shows that they did not really, not really interested in what might be the best for the country.
If this bill were to move, do you feel that some of these objectives ought to be written in, or this leave it completely to the discretion of the board?
I think the board, I mean, the feedback from which the board has and operates as a guidance, but I don't have any judgment.
Well, the board essentially now operates as its name as an advisory board for decisions generally not made by the board. In this case, this may well be the only decision that you've given to the board. I just wonder what's going to write something.
There will be no objection.
Is it credit here? Questions?
Yeah, a couple. Charlie, first the comment. Also disagree with Commissioner LaRusha's letters on what the new measure does and what's being sacrificed for protection of the state's rights to the oil, gas, local fire, and all that. It was one of the arguments that you may recall in the early days when that authority was set up. There were just so many words, because once the bonds were sold, what are you going to do about it? They really didn't do that much. But on the authority, of course, it's nothing new. It was proposed during the latter closing days of the session by a couple of people a year ago. And it surfaced as early as the year before, as you well know. The emphasis was placed on conditioning. On the bond authority, my recollection on that, Mr. Chairman, for your benefit, was that rather than create the new entity, we do have a bond bank, but they can go through and we just simplify the procedure. So, Charlie, on page 11, personal prejudice showing here, I guess, because of past experience. But as long as royalty, oil and gas, board is going to be involved in the preceding section 3135020, why not have them submit in 3135030 rather than the commissioner? The ultimate decision is made by him, but I would just feel better if they had reviewed the situation and came with a recommendation to him. because the way I read it now, it's solely discretionary on his part. I'd rather have
a group that had looked at it and suggested
the conditioning facility, the lease arrangement side, and the bidders that were involved. I mean, their recommendations as to who, in their opinion, should be awarded with.
It could be taken care of in line 7, condition of that resources shall come upon recommendation of the advisory board.
Yeah, on line 10, have as determined by the Alaska Royalty Oil and Gas Development Advisory Board. If the governor keeps to the policy he's had in the past, he'll still submit for ratification to us anyway.
I have no problem. The main thrust I have, Mr. Chairman, before we get completely left behind, is to certainly make a good faith effort to look at the funding of the additional plan. And so we own it, so we can deal and reasonably concern to everybody else involved. And I think we're looking at the other projects, which are going to bring a return to the state. Certainly, the intent that this will bring a return to the state, too, is not the money to spend. And we've said it, even have a rate of return, and all this is like public utilities, we actually have some decent percentage, but at least it would be an investment and give us some control over what we're trying to
do. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you know, at least my perception, the authority that's in place now had been created even by proclamation. The principle of Northwest is no longer necessary anyway. That was created when the state was, it was desirous for the state to have been one of the first participants in the line as a demonstration of the intent to pursue the project with vigor. When that didn't occur, the statement had been made public by now that in fact they didn't need us any longer. But the particular entity that was created just doesn't have any place any longer. And I certainly do agree with Senator Parr on the controlling condition, because we do have another measure that is being studied now. Conditioning may be the deciding factor as to whether the petrochemical activity in fact would occur. If you do have an excellent argument to make, those that do the conditioning, traditionally, industry will allow the option of payment for conditioning to be in product, which is gas liquids. I don't know what Dow Shell report's going to bring, but the amount of gas that's going to be processed if payment did occur in liquids might just be the deciding factor between the state's share and what a project might need initially to get started.
Yeah, I have a question. What is the time factor involved in, let's say, in this legislation and the condition plant decision at this stage?
Rumors I have it, and those are big, you know, mostly from releases that I've read. The Lieutenant Governor is a member of the Design Policy Board of the Consortium studying the big line. This condition plan has been determined by the participants as to the method of conditioning and location. But certainly there's still ample time to participate in the construction of equity ownership of conditioning, because the issue has not been resolved yet as to whether conditioning is an integral part of the line. McMillian's proposal does not include conditioning. It's a separate thing. And that cost is still being argued. But certainly, you know, this should be in place this year if possible. Next year might be too late. I don't know. Your guess would be as good as mine.
Can the conditioning plan decision be made separate from the gas pipeline decision?
The three majors are saying no. Of course, no conditioning, no line. Yeah. no line, no condition, you know. They wanted it an integral part. Northwest doesn't care what happens, other than the field at the well at the south.
And under this, the state could go ahead and build a plan.
Yeah, in any event.
Regardless of the plan.
There are intolerable additional delays in construction of a big line, this legislation still lends itself to pursuit of the liquids activity, because conditioning whether we're going to do the entire stream or just the removal of the liquids portion must occur. Both lines need the conditioning to sell. And yeah.
Senator, to address your question about time, the best guesses anybody has now is to begin the draft of construction on the line 6.64. Conditioning plant design and so forth and funding everything has to be done but ahead of time because at least the information I've had, it takes roughly the same amount of time to build a conditioning plant as it does to build a pipeline. So the time frame is actual construction is roughly the same. So the Lieutenant Governor's latest, at least according to the press, Lieutenant Governor came back from his latest trip down to meet with these people and said, it's rather gloomy about them getting to an agreement there. And I have had, I'm not sure what it is, a word that this, the price estimate is going to be made again. They have said, and I think that I'll be referred to, they said they don't need us. But I don't think they believe it. I think that's propaganda.
No, in fact, they might welcome some commission.
And it might be that something this sort could act as a catalyst of reducing the total cost to the other two participants. Besides producers and the distributors, and simultaneously, they're giving the state something, some role. The time frame, I'd say, should not be delayed unnecessarily if we're going to do it at all. I think we already run the time of the citizen. That's why I had to go in 2 years ago.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And something you have to describe as well.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Anselm Stockman, Treasury Comptroller of the Department of Revenue. And I can just start off and just give you, in terms of the technical, you already have Commissioner LaResha's letter, which has been given to you. My point here is more the technical aspects. I wrote the fiscal note on SB 257, and to clear up some of the confusion to a degree as to how this thing is structured, is basically this bill, after you go past the creation of the authority, that is on lines 14 through 20 of page 1 of the bill, everything else, to a degree, is almost, I'd be willing to say almost identical to the international airports that are run in Department of Transportation Public Facilities. So basically what you have, for intents and purposes, is what is similar to a state agency, just the same way international airports is run. That's the reason for the construction fund and the revenue fund and everything else that's involved. Also, the state bond committee makes all the decisions as to the sale of the bonds, you know, approving them and so forth. And that's the best perspective I can give it, and the fact that it really does not operate as an independent authority. It operates as a state agency, which is an extension of DOT, basically, is the way the bill operates. Do you have any other questions? That's the best summary I can give on it, because for trying to figure out for a while whether or not it was or was not an independent authority, but if you review international airports legislation, you will find that most of the sections that are in this bill are taken out of, you know, just modified for the Natural Gas Industrial Development Authority, and it's basically international air force.
And from that standpoint, do you feel that it's an operational device? Assuming the legislature approves it, it would essentially be able to function, carry out the purposes as stated here, Senator Park is right.
Mr. Chairman, I think
there may have to be, as you know, as a technical aside, this creation of the authority, but operating it as a state agency, needs to probably have some cleanup. You know, this thing either is an operating state agency, but it doesn't appear to have really a separate or distinct legal existence, because it operates so much similar to international airports to a degree.
Do those have a separate authority?
International airports, as I understand it, basic DOT operates it just like a state agency that operates a set of airports. There is no other formal board involved, and it operates just like any other state agency. It has a separately appropriated construction fund and a separate appropriated revenue fund, and it's operated as an enterprise fund, like a business of the state. And so it's kind of like the city and borough of Juneau's water operation. They are run as a business extended from the city and borough of Juneau. Same way, international airports are run as a business as an extension of DOT. DOT's has a certain section within it that takes care of international airports. The State Bond Committee approves all the bonds, and international airports has its own management structure, but there isn't an authority that takes care of its decision. So other than the leading word on creation of the authority here, you basically have what amounts to another state agency. I don't know whether or not that was intended, but that's how the bill appears to be written. That's just from a technical viewpoint.
We're looking at another model of an authority. The Alaska State Housing Authority operates within the Department of Commerce now. Is that structure statutorily different from what we have here?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is, because you have not only, let's say, Alaska State Housing Authority, but also Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which is not really called quote an authority, but and also Alaska Industrial Development Authority. They are created as an authority. They do, in fact, have a separate board that makes the decision on the bond. They do, in fact, have their own separate operation. And they are kind of, to a degree, an arm's length type of business for all intents and purposes. There are members from the administration appointed to the board. There are public members on the board. And it's kind of run as an arm's length business. They have their own financial statements and their own operating personnel and so forth. And they are not under the state's classified system, really. Most of them are, you know, under the exempt service and whatever. So there is more of an arm's length type movement for all the other authorities. This appears to be an authority in name, but in fact operate like a state agency.
And what difference does that make?
Mr. Chairman, the difference that that makes is to what degree responsibility takes place on the part of the state. It says here it has a distinct and separate legal existence. It has a legal existence independent and separate from the state. That, to a degree, is not possible when the State Bond Committee, the same ones that approve the general obligation bonds, and also approve the international airport bonds, are the same ones making the decisions on these bonds. There's a lot less separation involved. Now, all of these kinds of problems can be cleaned up, but there is a lot less separation because the same people who are passing on all the GO bonds are passing on the bonds for this authority. So there is a far closer relationship, although the intention is that this be a revenue bonding type authority, same as international airports, where the revenue bonds are the ones, this is not a full faith and credit, you still have a much closer relationship to the state.
I'd like to ask the department if you will to comment on this, whether it makes a difference to you which way it goes.
Well, no, I think the
Chairman, if I may comment, I think the problem is one of a technical nature, because I think because, for instance, the revenue fund and the construction fund are actually established within the state's framework. That's where part of the thing is. The actual revenue fund that is used to pay off the bonds are actually within the state structure and framework over the Department of Administration Division of Finance. They are established in this bill within the state system. And so that technicality may have to be taken care of, but that problem exists.
Could you help us take care of that technicality by tomorrow evening?
I'll try.
Okay. Why don't we try and resolve that particular issue, if it's a technicality, it should be something we could deal with. Is that agreeable? Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Park. Is there anyone else here on 257? If not, I see Representative Freeman here, so we'll change the agenda slightly. I assume you're here on House Bill 1 rather than Senate Bill 299. Are you here to make a statement or just whip us into action?
Mr. Chairman, I can do it either way you wish.
Would you please identify yourself?
I'm Senator Oral Freeman, for the record. As you are well aware, House Bill 1 is not a very lengthy bill. It's mostly a matter of philosophy, and I'm pretty sure that you heard from time to time my views as far as the philosophical approach. And if there are any questions on it, I'd be very happy to answer those or discuss the approach in any way you wish. And it's your convenience.
Well, subject to the wishes of the committee, it's my hope to bring the bill out today. In fact, I have a commitment to the chairman of Senate Finance that we will move the bill. And I might point out that the testimony we had last week at the video conference was overwhelmingly in favor of approval of this particular action. So it's my hope that we can bring it out with a few passes.
Mr. Chairman, I learned a long time ago when it appears you're ahead, you quit right then. I quit.
Thank you. No questions.
No questions, Mr. Chairman.
Send a letter. Give an objection to moving the bill out of the recommendation.
As long as you don't put it on the calendar right away.
It's going to finance, and I have a hunch that it isn't going to move very quickly at all.
Thank you very
much.
Sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Freeman. Now we're to Senate Bill 299. Senate Bill 299, as you may remember from previously getting into it and not quite doing very much with it, deals with a lot of technical and technical aspects of the election code. I have proposed adding to that a change in the election schedule, with the election filing date changed from June 1 to July 15, and the primary election date changed from the fourth Tuesday in August to the first Tuesday in September. And the purpose initially behind making the change that I proposed was to shorten the election period, hopefully cut down on the cost of elections. In addition, the latest developments are that several members of the reapportionment board have urged me to take some action to postpone the filing date next year because of the one-year residence requirement in the district in which an individual is going to run. And since district lines are being changed right now through reapportionment and redistricting, this would permit individuals to sort of adjust their location to the district in which they wish to run. And so that from that standpoint, this would this bill would serve that particular purpose. Now, we have a letter from Mrs. Polly dated April 28th in their folders, which discusses some of the problems raised for the elections officials in the changes of dates. And if you would like to come up, you might address the bill in general first, and then deal with the election aspect.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Patty Ann Pauley, the Director of Elections. Senate Bill 299 is, as Senator Fisher said, basically changes and problems that arose as a result of the massive revision to the election code from last year. Most of these are just simply corrections to things that we found that were going to be problems. There are two new sections that we're asking that be incorporated, and those are Section 8 of the bill, which relates to, and that's on page 3, line 10, and that relates to the questioning of voters of suspect qualifications. The intention last year during the review of the election code was to have a provision like this in that bill. However, along the way, we found that it had been dropped out, or it had been put in, and also that section had been deleted. Therefore, we were no place. So we asked that Section 8, which appears as a new section, be placed back in. And it does simply provide for the provisions for questioning of voters of suspect qualifications, and allows for any person present in a polling place basically to question that person, a watcher, a citizen, as well as the election board people. The other new section is back on page 7, line 5, provision procedure for state review. The intention had also been to have this section in that bill, but again, because of a numbering problem, we found that it did not appear. Therefore, we asked that this section be included. And this section simply lays out the procedures that are be followed when the question ballot and candidate and absentee canvas boards had completed their work. What do you do with ballots which come in after that time? This section lays out that they will be counted by the state review board, which means from the 15th, begins meeting on the 15th, and on the 8th day following the election, and that any ballots must be received by that review board by the 15th day following the election, if those ballots are to be included in the count. And I will say that we are finding that there are substantial numbers of ballots that are included in this category. And there are certainly ballots which are included, which come in even after this deadline, that the procedure is now laid out so that those ballots would be counted in the case of a recount or other such provisions or such things that would come up. The question of changing the deadlines, as Senator Fisher said, I have given you some of my thoughts in a letter dated April 28th. We do have some serious concerns, especially about moving the primary election date closer to the general election. We think that there are going to be three major problems if it is moved. One of those involves anything which will have a candidate's name printed on it, ballots, the election pamphlet, calendar, those type things. We will not be able to print or to have available in anywhere near a time, what we think is a timely manner. It takes a minimum of 2 weeks once the election is actually certified to get all the material prepared, ready to go to the printer, to see the proofs that we must get back from the printers whenever we are printing ballots. I'm sure you're aware of what a ticklish area that is. And then, of course, we are printing in the neighborhood of 1.2 million ballots anymore when you look at the varieties and kinds of ballots that we are printing. Now, of course, that's going to change slightly since it sort of depends on the numbers of election districts that there are and the numbers of ballots, different types of ballots that we have to print. And one of the information...
Could I?
Sure.
Would you mind
if I... No,
Where does the printing get done
now? Printing is done now in four locations. It's done in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and then a certain amount of punch card ballots are printed in San Francisco. So we are going to probably 6 or 7 printers at this time to get those ballots prepared. For instance, bond ballots will go to a different printer as opposed to what a candidate ballot would go to. A judicial ballot would also go to maybe as many as three or four other printers. So the printing contacts are sort of spread around because there's no way one could handle the whole thing. It's just impossible. So we just spread around. When we look at the time that it takes to complete, say, the primary election, as it is that primary occurs on the fourth Tuesday in November, we normally do not get the absentee ballots and question ballots counted. The canvas boards complete their work until mid-September. Mid-September, at that point, the election is certified. Anybody may request recount, of course, at that point. The Election Review Committee and the people who worked on that last year recommended that we have 10 days' time in which to complete a recount. Now, certainly that is taken into consideration a statewide recount. And when you consider that our primary elections are showing an excess of 100,000 people voting, to review those ballots, to review the question ballots, et cetera, it simply takes time. And so you figure 5 to 10 days to complete that before you can even begin to print the ballot. The preparation of the election pamphlets, which according to our statutes currently are mailed to the voters 30 days before the election, those deadlines would certainly be greatly affected. We think the date that we would have ballots available for absentee voters and to begin to send those out to the election boards throughout the state would be severely impacted. Those are some of our problems, or some of the areas that we see that are problems. We foresee that if we would be cutting into the time that people would have to get and receive their absentee ballots, and the time that the election boards would have to get their supplies and to have absentee voting available in the more rural areas of the state. Certainly if we had only Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai, those areas to deal with, we could probably go for a much closer election day. But we're looking at a minimum of 30 days to get our ballots and materials down to places like the Aleutian Chain. And, you know, if we don't get them in, we've just totally provided those people with absolutely nothing. So we certainly can understand the desire to move the primary filing date closer into the 1st of July. We have no problem with that. I do have some doubts about the July 15th deadline if we do continue with a late August election. If it's an early September election, I just think we're going to have problems with getting ballots and materials to the voters of the state.
Would it be possible for you to begin printing, even if there are a couple of recounts going on? For instance, a certain majority of ballots would be affected by recounts if you have run judicial ballots, propositions, whatever else may be going on.
Mr. Chairman, we do that anyway. We go ahead and, you know, bond ballots, judicial ballots, prints are not affected by recount at all. We do go ahead and send those off to the printers without waiting for, you know, areas that may involve a recount. And, you know, since we're already doing that, you know, it wouldn't be a change in our procedure or any time that might be saved.
To what extent do you utilize computers in processing ballot propositions, names, and so on?
Some of our printing firms do use computers in terms of the preparation of the ballot, the locations that are used on the ballot. Some of the smaller firms within the state do not have computers available to them. But there are some printing firms that we do that do make take advantage of computers in terms of preparation of locations for ballots, the numbers of ballots, you know, the times that we use for each precinct. They do use those.
I was wondering in terms of your providing them with computerized tapes of whatever form, where you could probably minimize the amount of time where they wouldn't have to set up or punch or do anything like that, create their own computer program or anything, or put the data into the computer where you could sort of plug in almost at the last second as a name, plug it in, and off it goes.
some of the things that we do now is, for instance, if we're not really sure, if we have some doubt as to whether a candidate's name might appear on the ballot, we do go ahead and make revisions, and some of this is done by computer, so that with this name in, this is what happens. Without this name, here is what happens. So that we're already taking advantage of those type situations now.
Yeah. I assume you've seen my April 22 memo.
Yes.
And which is in the folders that the committee members have. On page, do you have a copy?
I don't have a copy yet. Can you have an extra?
My question to you, if you look at the proposed schedule, let's say, on page 2, as I hear what you've been saying, you're essentially saying that you cannot meet that schedule.
I cannot meet that schedule. The absentee ballots will recount, in the 8 days immediately following the election. Under the new election code, we will begin counting those absentee ballots on election night, so after the polls close, we can begin to count ballots. Those ballots tend to come in mail bags full close to that 8th day. The canvas board in item B, which you show meeting for 8 to 16 days, we would be receiving absentee ballots and question ballots that can be counted as late as 4 p.m. on the 15th day. Now, those ballots will come in from all, we currently have 22 districts. Those ballots will come in from all 22 districts. You have to go back and change the totals for all 22 districts to take advantage of this. The candidate board cannot review all of those items in a day's time. We, of course, usually wait and count all these ballots that have come in later on the 16th day following the election. As a result, it's closer to the 18th or 19th day following the election before we are ready to certify to it. A recount, according to the current statutes, may last up to 10 days. And if we are dealing with a statewide recount, it'll take 10 days to do that recount. Now, if you have only one, say, House race to be counted, you can do that in a day. But there certainly is always the possibility that we'll have a statewide race that will have to be recounted. So to do it in 2 to 3 days, we did the 78 recount in like 4 days. We worked somewhere in the neighborhood of 16 hours a day to do that. And those boards, they're just accuracy.
I think we all
yes.
We didn't see, we heard about it.
Yes. So that accuracy was very poor. To print and package ballot in 10 days, there's no way that we can comply with that schedule. Number one, it takes us a day or 2 days to prepare those ballots to go to the printer. They have to do their work and then send us proof back. And we don't wait on regular mail for any of this. As a matter of fact, we gold screen it back and forth so that we maybe can get it that night and work late into the night and have it ready to go sometime the next morning. But when you have as many as 25 or 30 sets of ballots that you're proofing, after so many hours, you simply have to take a break and take a rest there. I would say that we need a very minimum of 15 to 20 days from the beginning of the printing process to the time that we have those ballots in our offices ready to be put in the mail. Now, the elections offices take and they have to go through and, certainly check the numbers of the official ballots. They have determined ahead of time how many ballots they're actually going to send to each of the precincts. So they take and they just simply package those ballots. First, it requires double checking.
I think you've convinced me that we probably shouldn't push you anymore on this one.
We certainly would do our very best to get those ballots out, but there's just no way that we can get them. I don't think any faster than what we are now.
Well, I would love to see maybe between now and next election what could be done to maybe increase the amount of automation involved, or maybe bring more people into the process, or whatever it would take to
try and shave some more time off, especially since in reviewing the times that other states use have between primary and general elections, we find that quite a few states have much briefer periods. And I recognize fully the very special problems we have for living into remote communities and problems with mail generally. Let's get on the question of the filing date then, which starts at the which is section 21 of the proposed committee substitute on bottom page 7, and then goes on to to almost to through line 25 of page 8. How far can we push that one?
I had a suggestion. You know, we might could even stretch this July 15th filing deadline, particularly because I know it's very important, certainly coming up in 1982 with the residency requirement. Through the July the 15th deadline, if we could take out those provisions which have require us to talk about candidates filing by telegram and putting their information in the mail at that time, if they had to have that information in by July 15th, I think we can make that filing deadline. But as long as we have that procedure in that says that a candidate may put his declaration in the mail on July 15th and mail it, then we have an additional 15 days in which to receive it. So that would make it August 1. I'm not real sure we can live with that.
Well,
but without that
mean,
provision, I think we can live with it.
Since it's what it would be, eliminating the telegraph and mail combination.
I don't know. Another one of those issues is reapportionment board. I don't know if they really have to accommodate
that.
They had a charge to have something completed and having happened in the past. I changed the schedule. I find no quarrel with shorter elections. If you want to do that, you know, let's just do it like a horse race. You run one race, have it over. Well, you do it in municipal elections.
Right. You have
runoffs. If an individual doesn't receive 40% of the vote, you have a runoff.
Well, that's even more radical than what I would prefer. I'm ready.
Why?
I think essentially because people are used to the system that we have.
I'm only municipal elections and they do state elections.
I'm only nibbling at the margin. I'm not about to take on the whole thing. I'm sure Diane Pollard would be happy if she only had to run one election rather than two.
But then, Mr. Chairman, you give me that runoff election, we'd have more runoff than we know what to do with it. As a thought, we could go back and check from, say, from the 1980 election. And see how many candidates filed under the telegraph provision and see how many took advantage of that provision. And I should be able to provide you that within just a day.
Could I request this? Could you provide us with that information and also advise us of what sections would need to be changed to accomplish that?
Yes, sir. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask a question. Even though there's a filing deadline, I don't think the change in filing requirement addresses what you want to get at. There's nothing that prohibits you from filing early, and you can campaign early.
No, but the problem that we're addressing here is that if we move it to July 15th and if people still can give their filing notice by telegraph, and then have 10, 15 days for the mail to bring the actual filing to the election office. Mm-hmm. But that simply wouldn't leave enough time for the election machinery to roll.
Yeah. But you have the same shortcoming for those candidates from the 15th of July to election day. They can't get their things ready either.
They can start early. On the other hand, my experience in just watching elections over many, many years has been that while some candidates may do some mucking around before the filing deadline, they really don't mount
a real political campaign until they know who else is in the horse race, which is a filing deadline, which essentially would slow down the increase the amount of essentially pressure and exposure upon the public.
Oh, true, but if they file on the 15th, and then they have to put an organization and everything together, and you get media, and if they aren't going to make it, those that are serious will be doing that all ahead of time anyway. They do it now. But the advantage is for the individual who doesn't know, the first timer, that there is sufficient time when the field's been identified for him to still get the necessary things he needs done. Half of these printers in town, we just went through it. 3 and 4 weeks to get the guide signed for whatever you want. Oh, they tell you, I'm going to have them done for you next weekend, and you're going next weekend. You know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, all you're doing by shortening is you're benefiting the incumbents. We know the rules. The newcomer, he's going to be left at the gate. Man, he decides to file on the 14th. And the 26th is here. And he's still waiting for the brochure to come.
Well, I was a newcomer. I filed on last day. Didn't decide to file last day. But my basic response to making the suggestion of another filing deadline to shorten the general election day, it was really to those people among the constituents who had been and tired by the time the election actually occurred of being harassed and back in their ranks, especially by television. I mean, there was so much resentment that you found that I was going through a door-to-door campaign, and I found an awful lot of
it. Well, I found resentment that on the 31st day of May, when you saw the slate. You know, TV, and that became an excuse. No, I'm being facetious.
Why don't we take a look at what we do here tomorrow? We do have to do the 7th tonight.
Yeah, that's 7th
tomorrow.
7th tomorrow, yeah.
There's one further change that has been suggested, and that's to section 1507060, which now says required registration information. Each applicant who, this is on voter registration, who requests registration or re-registration shall supply the following information under oath: name and sex, address, and so on and so forth. Suggestion has been made to delete in the first item and sex to have name only, since this would conform very much to general federal law practice and most state forms, and this is one of the few references left in law. There's no objection to that.
No,
and
no.
Right.
No,
right. Right. If there's nothing else from the course, thank you very much. So look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Meeting's adjourned.
Good, if he's lucky, I can't.